Our next case this morning is number 072438, the United States against Virginia Carter. Mr. Fox.
May it please the Court, I'm Brandon Fox on behalf of the United States. The district court in this case had an unreasonably drastic deviation from the sentencing guidelines and in doing so created an unreasonable sentence in this case. The defendant in this case laundered $1.8 million, underreported her income by $1.7 million, lied to prosecutors during the course of the investigation, also lied to FBI agents during the course of the investigation, refused to accept responsibility, went to trial, and at trial she perjured herself on the stand. She went to sentencing then, proceeded to sentencing, and had a sentencing guideline range of 87 to 108 months. And despite all of that, the district court sentenced the defendant to 24 months in prison with weak, if any, mitigating circumstances involved in the case. The district court's rationale was flawed, it was speculative, and the district court sentence should be vacated in the case. The mitigating factors that the district court relied upon were all flawed. The first that I want to address is that the district court stated that the defendant laundered the money based on advice from an attorney, from her divorce attorney, and that simply was not the case. The testimony at trial by the divorce attorney was that he did not know, he was unaware that the money was tainted when he gave advice to the defendant. And not only was he unaware that it was tainted, he stated that if he was aware, if he had become aware from the defendant that this money was tainted, that her husband had embezzled all of the money that was at issue, that he would have refused to take the case, that he would have referred her to a criminal defense attorney, and that would have been the end of it. But the district court stated and reduced her sentence based on a fact that was not in evidence. In fact, it was contrary to the evidence in the case. The second point that the district court relied upon was an expectation that the defendant would receive a lower sentence at the time that she was committing the offense. The district court found that the defendant would have believed that she was committing a crime but wouldn't be facing a sentence of 87 to 108 months at the time that she was committing the crime. However, there was no evidence on that. That was based on complete speculation. And even if that was the case, it wouldn't be a reason to reduce the sentence. And in fact, it'd be a reason to have made, I mean, it could be an aggravating reason if someone is justifying their actions because they're not going to be receiving the type of sentence. They're balancing what their benefit is from creating the crime to the detriment. And I believe that if you look at 3553A factors and promoting respect for the law, that it would call for a greater sentence in this case. And the defendant in her brief admits this point.
As I understand your argument, you're asking for a ruling that that sort of consideration is always improper. Is that right?
In this case, we believe that it's weak at best and improper. It's either weak or if non-existent. Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, there was nothing to base it on.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at here. Is this an evidentiary argument that the evidence doesn't support what the district court concluded in that regard, or that that's just not an appropriate factor?
Both in this case. And if it is, to the extent it's appropriate, it's very weak. It wouldn't justify the 24 months to 87 months reduction in the sentence.
But there are circumstances where it could be appropriate to reduce on this basis.
I cannot, as I stand here, think of a hypothetical where it would be appropriate on this basis to reduce it. There may be facts out there that would support it in a future case, but as I stand here, I can't think of a hypothetical where that would be the case. Another issue that the district court relied upon in mitigation is age, and he stated that the defendant was not at the type of age that he normally saw in these type of cases, when in fact in 20% of money laundering cases and 50% of tax fraud offenses, the defendant that has been convicted is 50 years or older.
How old was her husband?
Her husband was in his 50s at the time that he was convicted and sentenced, so similar age. If you look at another factor that the district court relied upon, it was the disparity with her husband, and you bring up Judge Sykes, her husband, and at the time that her husband was sentenced, he was facing a sentencing guideline range starting at 71 months, but he was in a different position than the defendant in this case was. Her husband had certainly embezzled the money, and that was a very serious offense. But at the time that he was sentenced, he had pled guilty. He had cooperated with the government in both telling the government about his offense and explaining to the government where the money was. and accepted responsibility, had not perjured himself on the stand at the time that he was sentenced, and he received the 71 months, the low end of the guideline range.
Well, you're not quarreling with Gall, are you, that says that a district court can take into account sentencing disparities between defendants?
Not at all, Your Honor. What we're just pointing out is that if you look at them, they are not like defendants, because the defendant in this case, Ms. Carter, had perjured herself on the stand, had refused to accept responsibility, and instead of cooperating with the government, she had lied to the prosecutors and the FBI. So, yes, the district court could consider her husband's sentence, but he also should have considered the sentences of defendants generally who were also like Ms. Carter, and he did not do that. The district court also found that this offense occurred over a short period of time, and that simply wasn't the case. The laundering occurred over a relatively short period of time, a three-month period of time, but her tax fraud offenses occurred over a couple of years, and her perjury occurred much later than that. So this was actually a group of crimes that occurred over a several-year time period. And that's also, you know, during the interim between her perjury and her money laundering, she had also committed offenses by lying to government agents. The district court also talked about whether this was the paradigm of money laundering offenses, and this was the paradigm of concealment money laundering offenses, and that's what the defendant was convicted of, both concealment and spending. The vast majority were concealment counts. So it was the paradigm of that type of offense. That should not have been a mitigating factor. Finally, if you look at all of the factors, none of them applied to tax fraud. And her tax fraud guidelines in and of themselves was 41 to 51 months, and she received 24 months, which was far less than the tax fraud guidelines called for. So she was the same age as 50% of the defendants. There was not an extraordinary factor there. It was the paradigm of tax fraud offenses because she underreported her income, just like any type of those cases would have those facts. She did not create or she did not commit those offenses over a short period of time. She did it over a two-year period of time. This was not an advice of counsel offense. She didn't have tax counsel. She had a preparer, but that was it, and he didn't testify at trial. There was no subjective belief about what her tax fraud offenses were going to carry in terms of a punishment, and she underreported $1.7 million. Unless there are questions for me, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. We'll hear now from Mr. Halperin.
Morning. My name is Rick Halperin. I represent Ginny Carter. First, ask the court to take note of the most significant procedural aspect of this case. Judge Leinenweber took the plea of her husband. He then presided over the trial of Ms. Carter, and then presided over the sentencing of Ms. Carter. So he had a wealth of information. The government's quarrel is not with me, and it's not with Ms. Carter. It's with Gall. If you look at the appendix submitted by the government, you will see that the judge considered the facts. This case is very unique. Generally speaking, we see money laundering attached to an underlying offense, usually fraud. In this case, all of the fraud was committed by the husband. The disparity in these cases, or disparities, was created by the government in the way in which they gave, provided benefits to the husband. They overlooked his money laundering. They overlooked the fact that this was nothing more than a raw Ponzi scheme. And more importantly, Ms. Carter didn't have a thing to do with it. So when they talk about a lengthy tax fraud situation, they are way off the mark. All she did was sign those tax papers. The evidence was, and this was a matter that the judge commented on her sentencing, if you looked at the first tax account, the judge himself agreed with me that that's something she might not notice. With regard to the second one, the husband didn't sign it. She did, and the judge said, at that point, because of the huge disparity in income, she should have noticed it. The government's wrong. Age is a very important factor, and that's why their quarrel is with Gall. It was different in Gall. In Gall, Judge Pratt emphasized, here we had a very young man. It was obvious to him this was a person who would not recidivate, who had shown credentials for leniency. It's no less true of Ms. Carter. She lived to be 61 years old without any criminal problems, and that's what the judge meant, and you can tell by his discourse in there. The government has not been able to show you, they're not going to be able to show you when they get up here, that he missed any of the 3553A characteristics and considerations. And age is not a weak factor here. What it really means is she led an exemplary life, which means she had no criminal involvement. She is somebody who will not, in the judge's opinion, recidivate. There's no evidence to show that that's not the case. And one thing that I think this court and all appellate courts should consider, it's only been briefly mentioned, is not only was she sentenced, she has 3 years of supervised release. And in Gaul, the Supreme Court found that very important when they said the probation is not freedom. So by the time she gets out, she's 64. She's got another 3 years. She's 67. But the most important thing is there are enormous distinctions between her husband's behavior, which the judge recognized, and hers. And what he was talking about is...
Mr. Halpern, I hate to interrupt, but just can you speak to this point of the judge's comment about her concealing the funds because of the divorce situation? In terms of what the testimony is there, because the government says that the divorce attorney denied that he knew anything about the laundering. He didn't know, you know, that the money had been stolen. And so his advice was to her as if everything was straight. You know, obviously she should preserve the funds and that kind of thing. Is that what the record shows?
No. Here's what happened. That was an argument that I raised when I asked the judge, because I hadn't tried the case, to vacate the convictions based on estimate. He correctly pointed out that the distinction in his mind, I accepted it, was that Esterman, the concealment here was concealing for her husband's creditors. At trial, and I'm only talking about a case that I didn't try, she had gone to a divorce attorney, and what the judge was saying is, in a typical matrimonial situation, the wife is advised, grab all of the money, you can argue about it later. What the government did at trial was show that she did not tell her lawyer at the time that the funds were tainted. And along that line, although it's somewhat attenuated, her husband got full credit for the money he paid out in premiums, which I think is wrong to begin with in terms of the way the probation report was. She would receive, it was $1.9 million. When the government says millions, they're wrong. It's $1.9 million. She did it over and over again. The government recovered all but $145,000. It was a very significant matter to the judge, and he commented on it. And it's a distinction that this court should not lose sight of. We're talking about whether the judge abused his discretion. The government hasn't made an argument to suggest.
So, counsel, just to go back to Judge Williams' question, I take it from your answer that the direct answer to her question would be no, the record does not bear out that particular factor that the trial judge relied upon in varying the sentence below the guidelines, that the attorney's testimony was, as the government has said, inconsistent with that factor that the judge invoked, that she did not take this action on advice of counsel and could not claim that sort of a spin on the facts in sentencing.
Here's what he said, and I'm quoting from his transcript.
I'm asking if it's borne out by the record.
Pardon?
I know what the judge said. Is it borne out by the record of the attorney's testimony?
No.
Okay.
It's not.
Okay. What about the issue of the frauds taking a place over a short period of time? We've got
the money laundering, you mean? I'm sorry for interrupting.
The money laundering taking place over a short period of time, which excludes the tax fraud, which occurred over a couple of year period of time, and the money laundering itself was not an opportunistic crime committed in a panic, but rather something that occurred systematically over the course of several months, as
well,
I understand the facts.
I'm glad that we're post-Booker and we're not talking about a Barrett, which has been narrowly limited. But in terms of the money laundering, it did take place over a relatively short time. As far as the tax fraud goes, it was the husband who did all the manipulations. It was the husband who gave the information to the tax preparer. And even the probation officer, and you'll see it in the PSR, you'll see it in our short appendix, admits they had no evidence she ever reviewed those tax returns. All she signed was so. If you want to say every April you have to file your taxes, fine. She signed it twice, but she had no involvement. The tax returns are related to the fraud and nothing else. They are not at all related to the money laundering. So the money laundering took place over a short period of time. True, the FBI came into her house. She had $600,000 hidden in the bed. She didn't tell them about it. But shortly thereafter, she deposited it in a bank account, which she knew was frozen. And what the judge did find impressive was the amount of money that the government recovered. Have I answered your question?
Well, I don't think so. The money laundering was properly characterized as a systematic scheme carried out by her directly, and she can't blame that part of it on her husband or attempt to spin the facts at sentencing in a mitigating fashion. It was several months. It was repeated trips to various banks conducted by her personally. So the judge's conclusion that this was over a short period of time and was therefore mitigated is just not borne out by the record.
Plus on
one
this,
of his conclusions.
Well, I understand that, but we have to take them one at a time and determine whether they're valid based on the record evidence in this case. And if they're not, they're off the table, and we focus on what is valid and then determine whether it's sustainable.
Your Honor, he buttressed his conclusions by saying that what she did was keep the accounts in her name, not her husband's name, so there is a transparency there. And she did it in his judgment, and he's the one who heard the trial and is familiar with the facts, to shield it from her husband's creditors. And she did it after learning, although there's an argument about exactly when she did learn it. She did it in order, as he said, to freak out and protect herself. If that's systematic, yes, it is. But that was the purpose. She didn't money launder in the traditional sense that she's part of a criminal enterprise or a criminal co-conspiracy and is then concealing the assets. That is not the case here. That's not what the judge said, and that's not what the record supports.
So on this, let me get to this tax return, because even if we give you that she didn't know, you know, in the first return, that she just kind of signed it and didn't know. The second return, which was over a long, was beyond this three-month period. What? That was one where only her name was there.
She's the only one who signed it. Why they? It's a joint.
So in terms of the legitimacy of the short versus long, that might be incorrect, too.
I don't see how they're connected at all.
The court makes that broad statement that everything occurred over a short period of time.
I think if you read through the I know I'm out of time. If you read through the entire sentencing transcript, you will see that he makes those distinctions and he understands the difference. But in terms of time, that just had to be with when you sign your tax returns. As a matter of fact, the last one wasn't even signed by her husband. I know I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Halpern. How much time does Mr. Fox have? Thank you.
My sense of this, counsel, is that the trial court was looking to achieve some proportionality with the husband's sentence. The husband got how much time?
71 months, and there's a huge difference between, obviously, the 24 months and the 71 months. So even if the district court, balancing everything, felt that the sentence should have been somewhat less than the husband's, he took a huge leap here by going down to 24 months. And I want to point out, too, on that point, that the husband did not commit the money laundering. Defense has insinuated that the husband somehow got a huge break by not being charged with money laundering. But the money laundering scheme that we charged the defendant with in this case was all done by the defendant. And her husband testified at trial, and he said he had nothing to do with it. She testified at trial and denied the money laundering, but also denied that her husband was directing her to do anything. The evidence showed that she was the one dealing with all the bank employees, so she was the one that committed the money laundering. The differences in their guideline range had to do with the fact that she refused to plead guilty, that she went to trial, she obstructed justice. It didn't have to do with the fact that she was charged with money laundering while her husband was charged with fraud. She would have received a lesser sentence than her husband had she pled guilty, accepted responsibility, and not committed obstruction of justice. That's the reason why they had differences in their sentencing guideline ranges. The tax fraud offenses, obviously the jury found her guilty of both tax fraud offenses. Beyond a reasonable doubt, we proved that she knowingly filed these false income tax returns. So it was over a period of 2 years that she committed those offenses before the money laundering offenses occurred. The defense wants to portray herself as someone who didn't know what was going on when she signed the tax returns, that her husband was more culpable. She was spending all that money. She was certainly hand-in-hand with her husband spending all the money.
Well, and the jury necessarily rejected that.
And the jury rejected the defense.
So it's a little odd that the judge would rely on that at sentencing.
I agree, Your Honor, and I agree completely, Your Honor. Transparency that the defense also talks about was rejected, obviously, by the jury because they found that she was doing this to try to conceal the money. And if you look at the facts, it certainly she wasn't trying to be transparent at all. She has a friend of her husband's come into the bank immediately after she withdrew $720,000 in cash from a bank account. He comes back in and puts the money into a newly opened safe deposit box where he doesn't even have an account at the bank. The bank later asks her whether her friend had anything to do with the withdrawn money, and she says no. So she's not being transparent in these transactions. Her husband's friend then later brings that money to her house. So these were not transparent transactions. I see that I'm out of time. Obviously, the government asked that you vacate the sentence imposed by the district court. Thank you very much.
Well, the court thanks both Mr. Fox and Mr. Halpern. The case will be taken under advisement.